This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Yes, you are here again with Professor Buzzkill, and once again with us here in the Buzzkill Bunker. It's Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. How are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific.
You know, here we are, November 2018, roughly when World War I starts to end, the 100th anniversary thereof. But we always talk about how World War I started and why World War I started in 1914, and then, of course, there was the 100th anniversary of that. We never talk about how World War I ended, and it didn't just end quickly. It sort of drags on. It's very, very complicated.
No, this story, I believe this story is not so well known. And
now's the
time to do it. It's the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I.
Yeah, so, November 2018 is 100 years after November 1918. Unless, of course, you're listening in 2019 when we run it as a repeat.
Or if you're using the Julian calendar instead of the Gregorian calendar. Yeah.
So, after all, it's the first big war where everyone talks about it as a world war. So, it must have started in a complicated way, and it must end in a complicated way. So, tell us, you know, what's happening in early 1918?
Sure, right. Set the stage. Yeah. So, as of the beginning of 1918, just reality check, the world and... the world is not at war the way the world is at war in World War II.
No, that's true.
Keep that in mind. But Europe, certainly, and European empires have been at war for about 3.5 years by this point.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And there is...
this is January 1918.
January 1918, and there is a huge amount of war weariness, with the exception of the Americans.
Yeah, right.
The Americans had ended the war the previous April 1917, but at this point, the Americans are still gearing up.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's right. We always think of 1917, but actually don't arrive.
We send a token force over in the summer of 1917, but it's a token force. And we are not, as is going to come later in this podcast, our weight is not yet felt on the Western Front. So, as of early 1918, the European powers and their empires have been at war for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
It's a great deal of war weariness. In the East, you've had major change.
Oh, in addition to the war.
The war. By this point, you've already had the Bolshevik Revolution.
In Russia, yeah.
The Russians' front has collapsed.
Yeah.
And there are these sort of on-again, off-again peace talks.
Oh, I never think about that. There are peace talks sort of just basically on
just on the Eastern Front.
Oh, okay.
And it's complicated because obviously the Germans have the upper hand. They've won.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the Bolsheviks are trying to sort of get their revolution up and running,
mm-hmm.
but they have no cards to play.
Right.
Their front is in collapse. And this is, especially in February, this is a period where the Germans can basically take a train with a machine gun on it and ride into a town and take it.
Yeah, that's right.
Unopposed. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Russian forces have just sort of melted away. So the Germans can dictate terms.
To the Russians, yeah.
To the Russians. In the West, you have this famous stalemate going on.
Yep.
The Germans had strategically retreated to their so-called Hindenburg Line in 1917, mm-hmm. which is a more mm-hmm. defensible position. They retreated a bit on the Western Front. But other than that, it's still this famous trench deadlock from the English Channel to the Swiss border.
Right.
The Americans joined the war earlier, but their presence has not yet been felt.
Okay, let's remind buzzkillers of the date of that.
Right. The Americans ended the war in April 1917. The Germans had gambled early in 1917 with the famous unrestricted submarine warfare.
Yep.
And they gambled that they could bring Britain to its knees by sinking all of its ships before the Americans got involved. That gamble failed.
Yep.
Britain was hurt but not crushed by that. And now it did bring the Americans into the war. And now the clock is ticking because the Western Front is a stalemate. And the Germans know at some point the Americans are the weight of the Americans, right? Their mm-hmm. industrial might, all their mm-hmm. new manpower is going to be brought to bear. The French had weathered a series of disastrous mutinies in 1917.
Right. Another topic which doesn't get discussed
enough. Exactly. Yeah. There, essentially half their army was mutinying and refusing to advance to their credit, because some of their idiot generals were wasting their lives all these senseless offensives. And so now the French army is in early 1918 pretty much in defensive mode. For the French, the British, the Germans, all of their manpower reserves in the big picture are dwindling by this point.
Okay, so the French and the British on the one side, on the Allied side, their manpower reserves are dwindling, and on the Germans and Austrian side too.
That's right. Because of so many years of warfare.
Yeah, yeah.
The
Germans,
often overlooked, the Germans are also really starting to feel the pinch of the Allied naval blockade.
That's right. It's an interesting sort of, not parallel, but opposite to submarine warfare.
That
they're being cut off too.
Yes, is that the Germans sort of are dominant under the water, but the British are dominant on the surface.
Yeah.
And they can bottle up the North Sea, and the Germans, you know,
they do.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're starting to see German issues with food supplies and malnutrition and food shortages and also domestic unrest. You're starting to see that already. Because of the hardships coming from this Allied naval blockade. The big breakthrough for the Germans happens in March 1918 when they hammer out the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with the Russians.
Okay, right, yeah.
This ends the war in the East. Lenin basically, over the objections of a lot of his comrades, he gives up a ton of territory in exchange for peace.
Huh.
He knows that has no negotiating strength. But he has to have an end to the war, because the Germans easily could have rolled into Petrograd. There was no limit to their geographic expansion.
Which is now St. Petersburg. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. But the Germans also want an end to the war, and so they cut this deal. Basically, the Baltic states and Finland and Ukraine are all lopped off of Russia, and there's basically a German puppet state put in place in Ukraine. Germany now has access to a lot of this grain, by the way, which is a big plus for them. But the most important thing is they can now transfer the bulk of the forces that have been fighting on the Eastern Front to the Western Front.
Ah.
That is huge. It's really hard to exaggerate how important that is. They basically transfer about 1 million men.
Yeah. So from the
East to the West.
The Russians pulling out of the war is, as Edmund Blackadder said, all the Germans turning around, marching west, using him as target practice.
nice Blackadder reference, by the way.
Yeah.
It's the best troops. The troops they leave behind in Russia as sort of a police force. They're like old men. They're sort of scratch units. So they do have to keep some men in the East, but it's a token force compared to what's shifted to the West. About 1 million men are transferred by rail to the West. And so by the time you get to later in March, the balance in the West favors the Germans really for the first time since 1914.
Okay. Yeah.
They now have in the West 192 divisions to 178 for the Allies.
Okay. Now that 192 and 178 doesn't sound like a big difference in just numbers, but in terms of divisions of military men, and that's a huge difference.
Yeah. No. Ideally, they would want to have like 300 divisions to the Allies, but they do have now. They have a preponderance. So they have superiority in men, and they also have a lot of units which have been trained in their new. They're called Stoßtruppen, stormtroopers, stormtroop tactics.
Oh, I think most people think of stormtroopers as a World War II thing, but this is pioneered earlier than that.
This is actually a glimpse of what you're going to see in the Blitzkrieg in World War II.
Holy cow.
Which is the way you break a trench deadlock is you don't just beat your head against the wall.
No.
You have these relatively light, heavily armed units that punch holes and then dive deep into the enemy rear.
You mean light in terms of the numbers of men, but the men are heavily armed.
Correct.
Right. Gotcha.
That's right.
Gotcha. Okay.
And obviously we're not using motor vehicles.
No.
But in other words, and you don't punch holes and then turn toward the flanks. You punch holes and keep going straight and get deep into the enemy rear.
Gotcha.
And you let your follow-on forces then mop up the forces you have surrounded by punching holes. If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, punching more holes. Yeah.
This had been sort of pioneered on the Eastern Front, and the people involved now come to the Western Front and train a lot of German units in these new tactics.
Okay.
So March 21st, the so-called Kaiserschlacht, the Kaiser Battle, is launched, the first of a series of offensives. The first one is called Operation Michael, I believe. March 21st, 1918. By the way, the Kaiser himself, just for those of you keeping score at home, he's a figurehead by this point.
He is
no longer in charge. Germany has basically become a military dictatorship.
Where the chief
of the German General Staff, Paul von Hindenburg, and especially the guy's title is Quartermaster General, but Erich Ludendorff, he is in charge of the military effort.
And at least informally in charge of the government too.
Yeah, exactly. It really is a military dictatorship. There's a parliament, but they have no power.
Yeah, okay.
And so these offensives at first, at least a couple of them, make what are, for the Western Front, spectacular gains.
And mostly the Western Front's been in stalemated absolutely. For a long time.
Absolutely, yeah, and the cliche is true. You've been literally fighting over hundreds of yards of terrain.
Yeah, right.
And often launching a massive offensive and maybe gaining a mile for all of your spectacular losses. And so especially the British Fifth Army is mauled in this first offensive, pushed way, way back. But like I said, you have a series of offensives, or actually five of them that last into the summer. At one point, the Germans get close enough to deploy their so-called Paris gun.
Now, we hear a lot about this. Is this one of those railway?
It's a railway gun. And by the way, it's not Big Bertha. That's a different weapon. Sometimes these two are confused. This is the Paris gun.
Okay.
It's basically this gun that has a super long barrel and can throw a shell 75 miles.
Wow.
Which for the time is amazing.
And at that time can hit Paris.
Can hit Paris. Okay. That's why it's called the Paris gun. And so,
Only one of them, right?
There's only one of them. Okay. It's on a railway car. It's massive. It takes a long time to reload. You can only fire like one shell every 20 minutes or something like that.
Oh, okay. Well, even still.
But it does, for a brief period, terrorize the population of Paris.
Oh, I can imagine just the thought of there's because a gun you hear big
this,
enough.
Yeah, you hear this whistle and you hear this and you don't know where the shell's going to hit. It's sort of like being in London during the V1 and V2 raids. It's a similar
in
thing.
World War II, yeah.
And there's actually one case where one of these shells hits one of the main support columns of a big French church during Sunday services and it brings the whole place down. It kills like dozens of people. It has no other effect. It has a propaganda value.
Oh, okay. That's interesting because you wouldn't think that just the idea of it, just the terror of it would be very effective, but not.
Yeah,
okay.
And there's a point where one of these offensives gets closer to Paris than that, maybe within 40 or 50 miles, and there is concern that if the front doesn't hold up, we might have to evacuate the government, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these offensives fail.
Oh, all right. Now, the interesting thing about this is we're talking about this big offensive, all these offensives, and yet it's in 1918, and they end up failing. Well, let's use that opportunity to take a little break, and we'll be right back. Okay, Professor, so we talked before the break about these offensives, these German offensives coming in from the east, bolstered somewhat by the Eastern Front troops, attacking France and even Paris. Why do they fail? They failed before we went to break, but why do they fail? It seems like it's going to be a steamroll.
Yeah, and their failure is important because this was Germany's last roll of the dice in an effort to win the war. I probably should have made that clear earlier because, if they're going to win the war, it's going to be this offensive.
Yeah, sure.
And they're in a hurry, and they do make these big breakthroughs, and it looks like a couple points that might actually work. In retrospect, it's clear that they failed for a whole bunch of reasons. One is, well, I'll just put it under the label Ludendorff, because Ludendorff gave no strategic direction to this campaign.
Okay, let's remind that he's technically the quartermaster general.
Yes, but he's in charge. He's effectively the chief of the general staff.
Right,
he is managing this campaign. He makes the decisions. And it's clear from his comments and the comments of some of his underlings that they have no strategic concept here. In fact, one of his army commanders, I think, basically says, well, we'll punch a hole and then see what happens. That is no way to run an airline, right? No. and then you see it in Ludendorff's subsequent decisions where, they'll have some success here and they'll sort of, rather than, for example, roll up, they have a point where they might be able to roll up the British and make it to the channel. And rather than do that, they plunge straight west.
They
end up gobbling up more territory to no end.
Right.
Right. You just sort of create these salients in the Allied line, and which, by the way, you lengthen your line, which means then you have more to defend.
Oh, that's right.
So
that's
if
right.
all you're doing is gobbling up this territory without crushing the enemy armies or knocking one or the other enemy powers out of the war, you've accomplished nothing.
And you might have knocked Britain out of the war by going.
That's right. You might have.
Northwestward.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
If there were some strategic concept behind this, who knows what would happen?
Yeah,
but there wasn't.
Yeah.
And then so they end up dispersing their effort. They, at a tactical level, will reinforce gains to no particular strategic end. And this is this is like first semester at the command and staff college. Like, you don't do this sort of thing.
Okay,
so it's pretty disastrous. But there are some other problems. For example, even when they're up against the British, it turns out they're advancing over old battlefields, like the battlefield of the Somme from 1916.
Okay.
Where the Earth has been turned into the surface of the moon.
I see.
So maintaining an offensive is very difficult because all of your supplies and your reinforcements and your ammunition and your artillery has to negotiate this lunar landscape.
Yeah.
Which is very, very difficult.
Over the trenches.
Exactly.
The old trenches, yeah.
So it slows you down on the battlefield and then slows you down because your reinforcements and your logistics can't catch up.
Yeah.
Because all the roads have been destroyed. It's all cratered.
Yeah, right.
There's no infrastructure. A lot of bridges destroyed, et cetera. Which would have been a problem no matter what on the Western Front, but particularly
in this
case.
Because you eventually had to cross
right.
it no matter what.
I mean, it's almost a reason why a big offensive is not going to succeed, at least not in the short term. Hmm. There are other problems. There are several cases where German troops who have punched a hole, they stop to engage in plunder.
Ah.
So much for the famous German discipline.
Do they need to stop?
They do, and this is because a lot of these troops are poorly fed. British and French forces have a lot of problems. Food is not one of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
French and British soldiers always have plenty to eat. Americans certainly will have plenty to eat. The Germans don't.
And so think of the food factor.
Right, so when you break into the British rear and capture a British supply dump, first of all, you take a few minutes just to marvel at how much stuff the other guy gets to have.
Yeah.
You know, like the cognac and the cigars. And it's like, wow, this is so unfair. So when you break through and get to see what the other guy had, you sort of marvel at it and then you can't help yourself. You're hungry.
Oh,
You've been on reduced rations, even though you're attacking, right? So you should be getting more than anybody and you're deprived. And so you stop to enjoy a little feast. And so that actually becomes an issue. Allied counterattacks don't help. After their initial defeats and initial being stunned by the German attack, the Allies do manage to counterattack in several cases, which slows the Germans
enough
down.
Enough counterattacks to make it slasher.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially when you attack, in this case, you suffer high casualties. Even though you enjoy success, it's at a high cost. And the first offensive, the Michael in March, even though it only lasts into early April, in the three German attacking armies, they suffer casualties of 20%.
20%?
So that's killed, wounded, missing. But still, that's 20%. That's one in five.
Ugh.
And these are not just any 20%. These are 20% of their best units. These are the best trained, the most fit, the most aggressive, right? These are your best soldiers, and now you're squandering them. Mm-hmm. And often overlooked, if that list I just gave you isn't long enough, it turns out that even the Spanish flu, which I think you did.
Yes, we did in 1918 Spanish flu. Yeah,
and that's already coming into effect. And apparently it hits German forces harder because so many of them are poorly fed, right?
Yes.
Their immune systems are not as good as French and British soldiers' immune systems because they're not properly fed. So a lot, you start to see, especially as you get into the summer, right, this was not an epidemic. This was a pandemic.
Yes,
this killed millions of people around the world,
including
a lot of soldiers and a lot of German soldiers. There are some other problems. The initial Allied collapse in the face of these offenses, and that's what it was. It was an initial Allied collapse, finally forces them to do something they should have done years before, which is to create...
Forces the Allies to
create a unified command structure. And one of the reasons why they win in 1918 is they finally create a unified command structure. In other words, they appoint a single commander who happens to be French. It's Ferdinand Foch.
Oh, right.
Famous French general. He is given overall, in other words, you might call it supreme Allied command.
Yeah, right.
And so this allows you, because the British and French several times in 1914 and later in 1918, they run into this where the Germans will attack between the two armies, the French and the British, and they won't be able to coordinate the response.
Oh.
And people like you and I are like, well, duh. I mean, shouldn't you put somebody in overall command? Now, of course,
official historical response.
Exactly,
duh.
I mean, right. Why is there a Joint Chiefs of Staff in the U.S. context, right? I mean, it helps to have a higher level of coordination, especially in this case, it has to be international, but they do it. And that's one of the reasons why they're going to win in the sort of big picture. And also, let's not forget, as these offensives peter out, the Americans start to arrive in growing numbers.
Yes, that's right. And the infusion of new blood is not exactly the worst sort of
metaphor.
No,
indeed. And this is not just any infusion of blood.
Right.
It's true that some American troops play some role in checking the third German offensive, the third of the five. And battles that American military history buffs will know, like Cantigny and Belleau Wood, where the U.S. Marines distinguish themselves, they really do give the Germans sort of a bloody nose, and they do play a role in stopping them. My larger point here is that the American troops aren't necessary to stop these German offensives. I think I made this point in another
yes,
episode.
That's right. I remember.
Now it certainly helps end the war when it does, and I think that was the point I made before. But these German offensives were already petering out even without the arrival of the Americans.
Yeah, because after all, you talked about why the offensives failed early, right. And it's not just
none of those
things.
Involved yeah. the right. Americans, or at least not directly. So, in other words, as historians would say, this is an event that's overdetermined.
Yeah,
right? You've got more than enough factors.
It's going to happen
pushing toward the direction of the collapse of these offensives. But the Americans do start arriving in growing numbers. Their arrival is huge in the big picture in other ways. The losses, if you look at the five offensives, spring and summer of 1918, the losses are generally equal on both sides. French and British on one side, German on the other. They're about equal in multiple offensives. But by June 15th, with the German casualties and the growing arrival of the Americans, we reach the crossover point. You can actually find this online. There's a graph that compares German forces with Allied forces in the West.
Yeah.
In early 19, especially after the collapse of the Russians in the East,
right, yeah,
Germans
are
way above.
Oh,
but then these events have start, and they start suffering huge casualties, and the Americans start to arrive. And in June 15th is where those two lines of the graph cross.
Gotcha.
So the German going down, Allied going up.
Yeah.
And then from that point on through November 1918, they get wider and wider and wider. And that's with Germans not being able to replace their losses. And the French and British can't replace their losses either.
No.
But they don't need to because they've got these Americans showing up.
And
the Americans are showing up at 250,000 a month.
Now, this is something that astounds me because it's I think people tend to think of World War II as the big technologically superior war and able to do all these things you could never do before. But if Americans are arriving at 250,000 a month, the technology World War One is pretty amazing.
Well, not
too.
Just technology, but sort of organizational
skill, that's what I meant.
And logistical acumen. I mean, it took a while. It wasn't instantaneous, but once it gets up and going, it is a pretty impressive steamroller. And so we have planned an army of 4 million men.
Yeah.
And now they're arriving at the rate of 250,000 a month.
Yeah,
and that's what the Germans know this. The Germans have their intelligence services, and they're like, this doesn't end well.
That's right.
This is an appalling rate of American arrival, and it has a devastating effect on German morale.
Okay, we have
plenty of evidence of this. So even though it doesn't mean the Germans immediately collapse once their offensive stop, not even close, but at both levels, high and low, the Germans have this just feeling of dread. Like, you see those Americans we saw on the other side of the line for the first time? We're seeing more and more and more of them. And
every month.
And this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Right? So let's say 500,000 Americans show up. Another 3.5 million are on the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, exactly. I mean, already in July, the Germans have this sense of, oh my God, like this is not going to end well.
No.
Yeah. Because, you know... well, let me give you a few more numbers. The German high command estimated that it needed 200,000 replacements per month.
Yeah.
They were getting 70,000 replacements from wounded people who recovered.
Okay, right.
Which, just parenthetically, may not be your very best soldiers because they're recovering from wounds.
No, sure.
Right?
And
you can play with, like, is this guy fit for combat? Sure, he's fit for combat, right? In other words, you can start playing around there and then maybe the overall quality will start to decline. Okay, so you need 200 and you're getting 70. Every year there's a certain number of Germans who turn 18 and can join the military.
Yeah.
Okay, that number as of mid-1918 is 300,000 total.
Oh,
not per month. Total.
Okay.
You need 200 a month. You're getting 70 a month from the hospitals. Okay, now you need 130 a month.
Yeah,
and to meet fill that gap, you have 300 total. Oops. That's a numbers game that I hate this phrase, but it is what it is. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
That is an inexorable fact of military life for the Germans in the middle of 1918.
They don't have enough.
They just
young
don't
men, new young
have,
men, so to
you know,
speak.
And by the way, if you look at the British and French numbers, they are encountering a similar problem.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter
because
they can play their American Express card. They just pull that out of their wallet again and again and again.
Yeah.
In fact,
when we talk about tipping point, that really is true about the sheer number of American troops.
Right. So I was sort of making a subtle point. In other words, the Americans weren't necessary to stop that German offensive. But
there's certainly
a big reason why the Allies win the war.
Yes,
which
absolutely.
Are two separate questions.
Right. Okay.
And like, for example, okay, so we get to by early August, not only have the German offensives been stopped, but the Allies can now go on to the counteroffensive.
Early okay.
August.
Right,
in fact, I think it's August 8th, which the Germans called like the Black Day of the German Army. Because the British launched this attack with a huge number of tanks, by the way, which the Germans really didn't have.
Yeah, and these are kind of new.
They're kind of new, but by this point, the British are cranking them out, and they've learned to mass them. They're super primitive by World War II standards, but they've learned to mass them. The Germans have 100 total for the entire war.
Wow.
And because they just didn't put any effort into it. And by the way, later on, they're going to learn that lesson really well.
Yeah.
So, right? Defeat has a way of teaching you the way victory doesn't. Anyway, the British counterattack, and they're relying really heavily on Australian and Canadian troops.
Again, more fresh. I hate to keep saying fresh blood, but it's true. It's fresh.
By the way, the British High Command doesn't want to do this.
No.
They have no choice.
Right, exactly.
They don't have enough British manpower, so they use Commonwealth manpower.
Right.
To a much greater extent than you've seen. They've used them before, but not on this scale.
Canada, Australia, South Africa. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're pressing them into combat in much larger numbers. So these Commonwealth forces, along with French forces, hundreds of tanks counterattack, and it's devastating. A lot of the ground they lost starting in late March because of the German offensive is regained very, very quickly.
Oh, okay.
So these salients are erased just in a matter of weeks.
Wow. So, and salients are the sort of differences that...
It's the bulge. It's where the Germans force a bulge in the Allied line. That those big bulges are erased very, very quickly. And so it's as if the Germans had gained nothing.
Might as well not.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we don't mean to keep talking about very depressing things on this show, but we do when we talk about war, especially World War One and World War Two. But right now, we're going to have to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers. Now, we left you August 1918, right, with the UK being able to use Commonwealth forces and, of course, the US forces we've been talking about.
Right, and also the French.
And the French, yeah. So by September, what's starting to happen?
By September, it's really starting to go south of the Germans a great deal. By mid-September, you now have an entire, it's called the U.S. First Army, Army. And keep in mind, there's a lot of politics here. Pershing, the commander of the American Expeditionary Force, is extremely jealous about extremely concerned to keep American troops under American command. And not, the Americans and the British and the French want, you know, to be given American units to do with as they please.
And the
Americans, obviously, we have to worry about American public opinion, et cetera.
That's right.
The president thinks. But we have enough troops in place on the Western Front that we can create an entire U.S. Army.
Oh, okay.
So this is it's going to be several hundred thousand men. It launches its own offensive.
Yeah.
So now the Americans really are getting involved in a big way. By all accounts, the American troops are super inexperienced, make a lot of mistakes on the battlefield, suffer a lot of high casualties, partly through reckless attacks, but you cannot doubt their elan, their dash, their high morale. Everyone just sort of marvels at how sort of aggressive and high-spirited they are, and it really does sort of infuse new life into the Allied effort and on the other side, it's additionally depressing to the Germans. Whereas they're not just anyone showing up. It's these Americans who are super aggressive on the battlefield. And this first American effort is successful. By the end of September, there's a general Allied offensive all along the line.
Okay.
So they have enough strength just to go over all out pursuing the Germans. And the Germans, the Germans are tenacious. Even though their morale is sagging, and they're, for example, many more Germans are being captured on the battlefield. Right?
Yeah,
the
that's right.
POW
that's right.
pens POW are filling up much more than they used to. You saw this in World War II as well. The Germans go down very hard. They're not routed.
They're
pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
They're still occupying northern parts of northern France and Belgium when they throw in the towel.
Yeah,
but they're being pushed back. late September, Ludendorff essentially has a nervous breakdown. There's really no other way to describe it.
Ludendorff, the major German general, has a nervous breakdown.
He's basically, for even maybe a few weeks, certainly for days, he's like incapable of exercising command.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Everything is falling apart.
Falling apart. He has no answers. There's nothing he can do to stop the bleeding. They've shot their bolt, basically.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to take when you're a proud German patriot and nationalist and you've been managing this war effort and now you're looking to defeat and humiliation in the face. That's not easy for anybody.
Hey, now, at this stage, Germany still has some allies.
Yes, it does.
What's happening there?
And that's the other thing. Folks will forgive me for focusing so much on the Germans, but they do lead a coalition.
Yeah.
You have the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. You have the Bulgarians.
Right.
And you have the Austro-Hungarians.
Right.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire. These allies have also started to collapse coincidentally at about the same time.
Ah, okay.
By September 1918, they are also on the rope. Bulgaria, for example, opens talks with the British and French for an armistice in Greece. The British and French have opened a front by this point. It's called the Salonika Front.
Mm-hmm.
This is in Greece, which was occupied by the Bulgarians. And the British and French forces there are starting to push farther and further north, and the Bulgarians can't wage war anymore.
Now, this must not have gone over very well in Berlin.
No.
Hearing that one of your allies is making separate deals.
Right. No, and the sky is falling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your focus is the Western Front, but now all these other fires are breaking out, and you can't put them all out.
Wow.
The German, about the same time, so by late September, the German high command realizes that Germany must make peace, that their one chance of either A, winning, or B, not losing, which is not the same thing,
No.
Though those chances are now down to nil. And so then, like anyone else, you have to end the war. How do you end the war?
Right, exactly.
You want the most favorable peace possible. What the Germans quickly reach to is... the Woodman's 14 points.
This is President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, known in the Buzzkill Institute as the Woodman.
The Woodman. January 1918, Wilson had issued his famous 14 points, which, long story short, offer a reasonable or a humane peace.
Right.
A peace without victory, as he famously says, where you don't see, so hypothetically speaking only, where you don't sow the seeds of the next war by humiliating the loser and taking all his territory, right?
Yeah.
He understood that dynamic and wanted to break it to his credit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so if you're the Germans, you say, oh, wow, now that we're losing, we love the idea of a peace without victory. And you see, the parallel I would draw here is with the Japanese at the end of World War II, you're losing badly and you know it, and still you hold out hope. Well, maybe we can keep Poland. Maybe we can keep parts of Alsace-Lorraine, which is amazing. These are the two eastern provinces of France the Germans had swiped in 1871, and which the French had been dreaming about getting back. The idea that you'd be able to keep an acre of that territory after you lose the war to the French is just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it really makes you wonder what they were smoking in the German high command. But they still thought, Wilson's a powerful guy and an increasingly
and has lots of influence.
Exactly. And his influence is growing within the Allied camp. And if he's serious, maybe we can reach out to him. British and French aren't going to like it, but we can reach out to him and maybe get a peace that's reasonable considering how badly we're losing on the battlefield. The additional complicating factor for the Germans is they realize that to have some credibility with the Allies and maybe to get this sort of Wilsonian peace is you have to change your government.
That's almost as difficult as doing these other things.
Yeah. It's like, how do you change the unchangeable?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, how do you take this military dictatorship with a monarchical gloss and in the middle of a war, change it into something that's representative?
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that.
How are you going to have elections? I mean, it's going to be immensely complicated.
They try. And so, for example, the Kaiser fires his chancellor and replaces him with a relative, actually, the moderate Prince Max von Baden. He's German nobility, but he's a moderate. He had long been known as someone who, I wouldn't call him a peacenik, but he wants a negotiated peace because he fears that Germany is going to get crushed otherwise.
He's a realist. Yeah.
He's much more realist than a lot of German generals are. No question about it. And not only is he named chancellor, this government, this new government is given significant power.
Oh, okay.
Including the Reichstag, which in the existing system was a rubber stamp, it was a debating club, which had no real legislative power. Mm-hmm. Well, now it starts to get some real power. Mm-hmm. And Max von Baden, he takes into his government representatives of multiple parties from the Reichstag.
All right, so he can claim that it's a truly national effort.
Right, and that it's representative, even though we didn't have national elections, right, and it's still a monarchy. Nevertheless, here we have a government, and for example, even the Social Democrats, the SPD, mm-hmm. they have some representation in this body, which is unheard of.
Yeah, that'd be unheard like bringing of. In, the, I don't know, I can't think of one in the United States, but it'd be reaching way out.
If you're the Kaiser, you know, these are people you think belong in jail.
Yeah, that's
and now,
right.
And
yeah.
now they're in the government. Okay, yeah. So that's how amazing this is.
So what are we in still late October? Are we near?
Fast forward to late October and early November, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is collapsing. Mm-hmm. They, by the way, on the Italian front, the Italians have been defeated badly in late 1917.
Yeah.
Now this front has been shorn up with a lot of British and French troops. On the Italian front, often overlooked.
It's not
just Ernest Hemingway who's serving on the Italian front as an ambulance driver.
But this is why one of the reasons why World War historians talk about World War One being so much more complicated than World War Two.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Always new layers. So Austro-Hungary, who was on the winning side against Russia, but had been greatly weakened by the war against Russia, and it's a weak empire to begin with, and now they're getting hammered on the Italian front. And basically what's happening here, it's a multinational, multi-ethnic empire, mm-hmm. and it starts mm-hmm. to break up almost spontaneously. It starts to break up. The central government can't keep it together anymore, and all these constituent people, Serbs and Croats and Magyars and Czechs and Germans, they all start pulling apart and declaring their own republics. So, and that's totally separate from what's going on the Western Front.
Yeah,
at roughly the same time. So, by the way, and if it collapses and Germany doesn't, okay, now you have this brand new Southern Front that's a couple thousand miles long that you have to worry about if you're the Germans.
Absolutely.
And the Ottomans are also collapsing. This took a little bit longer, but by this point in the war, the British are advancing through Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on their way to Damascus. Mm-hmm. So if you know your geography, the Eastern Mediterranean is all falling to the British.
Yes, absolutely.
A largely Indian army under mm-hmm. British command is advancing in Mesopotamia, today Iraq. Headed westward or northwestward. And so the Ottoman Empire also is collapsing and starts to sue for peace. So, and there's also an Arab revolt. Let's not forget about that.
Right.
We have to give our props to Lawrence of Arabia, and all that good stuff.
He gets the royalties from the Buzzkill
Treasury.
So
in that sense, the Ottoman Empire is also collapsing from within, right? Which is what that represents.
Sure.
By the time you get to circa November 1st, Germany is essentially alone.
Okay, now this is important.
Give or take a few days, Germany is alone.
Okay.
Its three coalition partners either have sued for peace or are suing for peace.
Okay.
By the time you get to November 1st. Germany is fighting hard, but it's falling back, suffering more and more losses to prison as prisoners rather than as sort of casualties.
Yeah.
And then there's this odd moment often overlooked where the German Naval High Command...
Oh.
Because remember, the German fleet is large, but, you know, they went out and fought the Battle of Jutland.
Mm-hmm.
Big clash, pretty much indecisive in 1916. After that, they were bottled up in port.
That's right.
And so you've got this big military asset that's just sitting there. And so the German Naval High Command, and I wish I were making this up, the German Naval High Command says, basically, let's go out in a blaze of glory. Let's fire up the boilers, steam out into the North Sea for one last showdown. Who knows? Maybe we can take on and
break
win
through something. Yeah.
Yeah. And beat the high seas fleet, beat the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
this is so obviously an effort to go down in a blaze of glory, which everyone knows the Germans will lose, that German sailors start to mutiny.
Oh, okay. By sailors, you mean the lower ranking people in the Navy.
The people who actually have to go out and fight these battles think it's a bad idea. And because there's growing unrest at home, and of course, all these sailors are also aware of the fact that Germany is losing the war.
Mm-hmm.
They're aware of the unstable political situation.
Mm-hmm.
They're aware of the sort of strikes and food riots and things that are spreading across Germany. And so they decide to jump on the bandwagon.
Yeah,
and they mutiny. They take control of these ships. they start to take control of some of the port cities like Kiel and Hamburg and Bremen. Yeah. They start to sort of exercise their political muscle because they're all armed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're out on the street. And so, as you might imagine, there's by this point growing pressure on the Kaiser to abdicate. In other words, to give up your throne, step aside so we can end this war. Literally, in a place like Berlin, revolution threatens.
Yes, yes.
German communists are starting to go on the war path. And by the way, making common cause, like in Russia, with a lot of these soldiers and sailors who are armed combat veterans or at least trained in combat.
That's often forgotten in both World War One and and in the Russian Revolution.
There is this thing, 1918-19, called the German Revolution, which is breaking out now.
Yeah. November, by now, we mean November.
Yes, right? Early November 1980. So all this complete mayhem is breaking out at roughly the same time.
And it's impossible to keep this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the country going.
And the idea that there's anyone who thinks that you should fight even for a few more weeks is just amazing.
Yeah.
So November 9th, Prince Max hands power over to the head of the Social Democrats.
Right.
Friedrich Ebert is his name. He's going to be elected chancellor a little later on when they actually form an official new democratic system. But for the moment, he is now the chancellor and head of the government. The Kaiser abdicates only after briefly considering using the army to crush his own people.
You mean turn it around and crush these rebellions?
Because his attitude is, okay, Germany is sort of falling apart, but the army is still loyal to me. I still have this overwhelmingly powerful instrument. Yeah. So I can, you know.
And I'm the one thing in Germany left.
Right.
So
he's sort of fantasy land, basically. He's not even in Berlin. He's at Spa, which is where the German headquarters is on the Western Front.
Yes.
Finally, the people around him talk him into throwing in the towel.
Your
Majesty, you're no longer Your Majesty. You need to go.
Your Majesty, you're no longer
Your Majesty. A game over, basically. And so he abdicates. He flees into exile in Berlin. Parenthetically, he lives in exile in Holland. He's in Dutch exile, and he lives long enough to see the German invasion of 1940.
That must have been a very, very strange...
And a little awkward if you're Adolf Hitler, right? Because, you know, there were still monarchists in Germany who probably figured, well, let's put him back in charge. It didn't
happen. History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It rhymes, exactly. He dies in 1941. So he's now off the scene. A German republic is declared that same day.
The rush of events,
the same day, November 9th, a German republic is declared, a republic is declared by the head, by one of the heads of the Social Democrats, basically just goes out on a balcony, the Reichstag, and says, hey, we have a republic now. What up? Harsh armistice terms are finally accepted on November 11th.
Now, this is the famous
11-11-11-18. So the Germans had already sent negotiators through the line. They sit down and negotiate an armistice. Uh-huh. Extremely harsh terms, among which are that the Allied blockade remains in place to enforce compliance with this armistice and then later forcing the Germans to sign the Versailles Treaty. The Allies... I'm not trying to be funny, but they go completely gangster on the Germans at the end of the war. Some Germans are starving or are malnourished, and this blockade remains in place. It's going to turn out for another 6 months.
Right.
So the Germans really do, after this, negotiate and tolerate an occupation with a gun to their head. So the war finally ends after 4 years, 17 million dead.
Yes. Again, why it's called the Great War.
It's called the Great War. Obviously, it's a great moment of... triumph, sure, but also relief that the killing has finally stopped. Obviously, there are big parades in places like London and Paris and in New York. But it turns out, if you look at the peace, if you look at the 1920s, a lot of troubles are just beginning.
Absolutely.
That's how I'd wrap it up.
And dragging out this, well, not dragging out, but having the events, the military events of 1917, 1918 drag out so long.
Exactly.
Because when Germany's down, it's then down and out.
So this is where you see the origins of this stab in the back myth.
Oh, right.
Keep in mind, German forces were still on foreign soil.
Yeah.
There was a news blackout in Germany. Your average German, including your average German soldier, like Lance Corporal Adolf Hitler, they didn't know the truth of the military situation.
Right.
And so they quickly believed that, you know, honorable German forces can never be honorably, you know, honestly defeated on the battlefield. It had to be traitors. It had to be Jews. It had to be civilians. And, yeah. you know, before too long, you have people like Paul von Hindenburg who are testifying in public, like, yeah, we really didn't lose on the battlefield. We were stabbed in the back. Even yeah. though he was personally involved.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, personally involved in helping helping civilians take part of the responsibility for the defeat.
Yeah, it's just so the 20th century, certainly the first half of it, maybe longer, is just so disheartening.
It's one big chain car wreck.
It is one big chain car wreck. And it's as we talked about in another episode about the death tolls of World War II, but also with this massive death toll, it's just
right. And it leads to all sorts of disillusionment
and
dehumanization and bitterment and all this other stuff that you see even in victorious countries, like, you know, the whole lost generation of authors.
Yeah.
All this disillusionment after World War I makes the victory really, really sad.
And so it finally ends, and we've explained how it did end, but of course, as they say, it sowed the bitter seeds of defeat for all sorts of sorts of ways.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. And as we say to our buzzkillers out there, we will talk to you next week.